Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's annliguori.com. And distributed via my podcast on Audio Boom and iTunes. This morning, you will hear a conversation I had with Hall of Fame golfer Pat Bradley. Pat won 31 LPGA Tour events, including 6 major championships, all her major titles won in the 80s. She was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1991. Pat was honored with Beth Daniel at the 2024 LPGA Founders Cup, which pays tribute to the 13 founding members of the LPGA. And each year, the Founders Cup recognizes other Hall of Fame golfers and greats who really helped make the LPGA Tour what it is today. I also visit with Ward Clayton, author of The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National. And we discuss the history of caddies at the famed course and how they witnessed some of the greatest moments at Augusta National, beginning in the 30s, from Gene Sarazen's shot heard round the world to Jack Nicklaus winning a record 5 of his 6 Masters titles. And then we go across the pond to Ireland and an extraordinary links course called Carne, C-A-R-N-E. Fiona Taher, the general manager, chairman Jerry Maguire of Carne, they share the club's incredible history, the extraordinary dunescape topography there, and how the global golf community ensured its future during tough times. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. It is my pleasure to welcome in the legendary Pat Bradley. Pat and Beth Daniel have been honored all week at the Cognizant Founders Cup, the LPGA tournament taking place at Upper Montclair Country Club in Clifton, New Jersey, which honors the 13 founders of the LPGA. And boy, what a pleasure, Pat Bradley. Great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Ann. It's nice to be with you. We were together many, many years ago in discussing golf, so it's nice to be back with you again.
Yes, you were one of my guests on Sports Interview, a cable show I did for, 17 years. And that was a long time ago, Pat. You look obvious. You look like you're just beautiful and you look so young. Oh. And 31 career wins, 6 major titles. You played on 3 Solheim Cup teams and captained the 2000 Solheim Cup team, inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 91. I could go on and on and on about you. And, you know, I just love this tournament, Pat. I mean, I talked about it in last Sunday's show as well. Any tournament that recognizes history, and in this case, the 13 founders, right? I just love it.
Exactly. And I mean, if there weren't our 13 incredible women that persevered, had passion for the game of golf, had passion to start an organization where women could play in tournaments and display their skills, you know, we wouldn't be here today at Upper Montclair. So it was, I knew many of the founders. In fact, I played with a few of the founders, Patty Berg, Marilyn Smith, Marlene Hagee. So to honor them as often as we can, it's what we should do.
Absolutely. It's such great education for younger players and fans, and it is what we should do. I just love every second of it. So how has the week been for you?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. You know, Beth and I have had a great time. Mother Nature hasn't been too kind to us, but, you know, we are in New England in May, and these type of weathers can happen. But I got to tell you, Ann, these athletes, these players, they're just displaying great golf under tough circumstances with the cold and the wet. They are not letting anything bother them, and they are shooting great numbers. I mean, Rosang and the young lady from Sweden, they are just displaying some incredible golf at this. It's a great golf course, Upper Montclair. It tests every shot that a player has, and that's what a championship golf course should do is test every club.
Absolutely. I played had the great opportunity to play with Minji Lee in the Pro-Am, who won this event a couple years back. And she said this is the hardest course that she thinks that she's played on the LPGA Tour. It's very tough. And as you say, the weather conditions have been, you know, you had some rain, you had a lot of wind. Madeline Segstrom leads at 19 under by one shot over Rosang. And these two, it was so compelling. I couldn't take my eyes off the coverage. You know, they are just playing lights out. I mean, incredible play.
They are, and lights out. They are 10 shots, basically, 10, 11 shots ahead of third, which is, you know, Nelly, who's a fabulous player and, you know, was trying very hard to win her six in a row. But, you know, it's interesting. And I won on this golf course in 1983. It was called the Chrysler Plymouth. And, you know, it is just testament to this great golf course that it has stood the test of time over these many years for these very talented athletes to be here again and test their skills.
That's right.
It is amazing that this golf course still holds up. And, you know, these young kids are you're just playing great golf. And to see them fly that ball into these greens with tough pin placements, I mean to tell you, these pins are not just in the middle of the green. They are really on corners of the greens, which can be diabolical if you miss the green. And that's how good these young athletes are today.
That's right. It's so incredible to watch, you know, even, you know, Segstrom, when she wasn't in great position, got up and down to save par. Yeah. So did Rosang. And, well, of course, obviously the biggest storyline, Nelly Korda playing to win a record-breaking six straight title. She did not have a Nelly Korda kind of day yesterday. She carded a +173 and at 8 under overall, she's 11 shots behind the leader, Madeline Segstrom. But what are your thoughts about Nelly Korda? What a journey it has really been for her and will continue to be.
Well, you know, I think, you know, she is a generational talent. I mean, you know, there was Nancy, there was Annika, there was Lorena Ochoa, and now there's a Nelly Korda. I mean, this young lady has everything. She has the total package. And, you know, she might not have won her sixth in a row, but I wouldn't put it past Nelly to start another run further down in the year. I mean, that's how talented she is. And she is just a wonderful young lady. I've, you know, met her this week. She's very humble. She's, you know, and then, you know, to walk the carpet at the Met Gala, she was absolutely stunning.
Yeah, beautiful.
And she has taken the LPGA to a new level, both on and off the golf course. So I am really proud of her, and I wish her all the best. I know, you know, you never say, you know, something could happen today. I mean, she could shoot 62 today, and, you know, the others might stumble, but you never know, but still, what a tremendous talent, and what a great ambassador to our tour.
Absolutely, and just being at the Met Gala, looking stunning, you know, she said she got out of her comfort zone a bit by going, but all that exposure is so great for her and the tour, certainly.
Exactly. Yes. And it'll just help her grow, you know, and mature and get stronger and stronger, both on and off the golf course.
Now, in 78, Nancy Lopez won 5 straight tournaments and you snapped her win streak. So talk about them. What are your memories from that streak, Pat? And, you know, I'm interested to know what the attention was like back then from a media and fan perspective.
Well, I'm sure Nancy was, I'm sure the media attention Nancy received wherever she went was over the top. But, you know, she was being wooed by her first husband, who was a sportscaster in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And, it's hard to, go under the radar when you are trying to go for that 6-1. And I just had a great week. She didn't have a great week like Nelly, might be having, today, but, records are made to be broken, and I broke her record, and she's still not happy about it. and a lot of her fans weren't happy. I received some very stern letters of why did you do that to Nancy, our Nancy? But anyways, it's all been fun. We're having a good time with it lately. But I know Nancy's probably very happy today that her record is still intact.
Talk about, Pat, how far the LPGA Tour has progressed, since you played in terms of prize money. I mean, today the winner will earn $450,000. Now, obviously, if you compare it to the guys, because the winner today at the Wells Fargo on the PGA Tour event will earn $3.6 million. But when you consider what you guys played for, you gals, and what the women are earning now. I mean, how do you look at all that?
Well, I mean, it's wonderful to look at. And I mean, this is what my generation was to do. We were to leave it better for this generation to enjoy life, to not have to work, the off season. When I joined the tour in 1974, and we had about 30 events. Now, the total prize money with those 30 events that needed to be divided up between 80 players, we played for $1.2 million. Now, these young ladies today, these athletes are playing for $120 million. Now, I mean, that's just incredible. We celebrated Judy Rankin in 1978, I believe, to be the first woman to reach 100,000 in a year. So, I mean, the tour is just growing. It's big business now. And I mean, we were kind of like a little family back then. We were, traveling, together. We caravanned together. This is big business. Nancy was probably the only one that had an agent back there. These young ladies, they all have agents. And you have to go through the agents to get to these young ladies. They're so busy. It's almost a 24/7 job with their social media and their Twittering and everything. They have a lot. They got a lot on their plate. And then they have to travel the world. I mean, we traveled out of the country, but, we did go to Japan. We went to England, but these young ladies, they're gone at, months at a time playing out of the country. And that's not easy. The traveling is getting tougher and tougher. But they're earning great money, and they're displaying their greatest gift, and that's the game of golf.
That's right. The progress has been incredible when you hear your perspective and you hear how far the LPGA Tour has come since you played. Before I let you go, this week you announced that the Massachusetts Golf House will house your many trophies and memorabilia. You'll even have your own room there across from Frances We Met. I mean, that is so great. Congratulations, Pat. That is super.
Oh, and thank you so much. I am thrilled to know where I am going to, be for the rest of my life. The Mass Golf House has been just wonderful in helping me through this process. We are now working on doing the build out of the room. And as I say, I am right across the hall from Frances We Met. Down the hall are the Curtis sisters. And on the other side of me is Donald Ross. So I have some great neighbors that I'm going to spend time with. And to keep my collection, I have five brothers and I could have divvied it up. But, and they don't want to worry about my stuff. They don't want to have to deal with it. And being being born and raised in Massachusetts, I only live, 40 miles from the golf house. To keep it all intact, I am just thrilled. I couldn't be happier. I look forward to when we announce the opening of the room and having people come and gather. And I can share my stories of each trophy that I won.
I love it. Well, congratulations on all your success. Enjoy the final round at the Cognizant Founders Cup. And I can't wait to talk to you again. Pat Bradley.
Thank you, Ann. And thanks for all your support that you give to women's golf and to the game of golf. Thank you, Ann.
I am recording this segment for the show in Western Ireland, in the town of Balmullet, at an extraordinary golf club called Carn. I've traveled throughout Ireland extensively through the years, taping TV shows to tell the story of many of the hidden gems, the incredible links courses in this country, which has one-third of the world's links courses. And Carn has such an incredible story all its own. And joining me this morning to tell it is chairman of the club, Jerry Maguire, and general manager, Fiona Taher.
Thank you, Anne. You're very, very welcome to Carn Golf Links. You're a great ambassador for us, and we love when we get you over here. And we're delighted to be on your show this morning to tell everybody all about Carn Golf Links.
Well, first of all, Fiona, can you explain exactly where we are geographically in Ireland?
Okay, Anne, you're very welcome to Carn as well, just to echo what Jerry said. Where we are, we're the most western point in Ireland and indeed Europe. So we're right out on the Mullet Peninsula, a small area called Erris, which the centre of which is Balmullet, a tiny town really, with just around 2,000 people in it, and we're out on the peninsula, spectacularly scenic. And the best hospitality in Ireland, I think.
It certainly is. I can vouch for that. And Jerry, this topography is spectacular. The dunescape here, all seemingly focused in this one area. It's really an extraordinary piece of property.
It's an extraordinary piece of property. And it was great foresight on the five business people in the town who recognized the property, that it could actually turn into a world-class golf course and bring tourism to this part of the world, because there is no industry in Balmullet. And the whole idea was to bring as many international visitors to this part of the world and to create jobs for the local economy and indeed for the golf club itself. So thankfully we're at the stage now where that's happening, thanks to all the people in the United States. Many in upstate New York, California, we have them from all over the world, from all over the states, and it's been the lifeblood of Carn. And now we're getting like almost 13,500 rounds this year, when we were only doing 2,000 rounds back in 2017 when Fiona took over as general manager. So she has been the lifeblood, I can tell you, making sure Carn is on the map.
Fiona is an award-winning general manager. Brag about the general manager here, because she is just extraordinary in herself.
Well, look, the day she came is the day we got lucky. And She's just a fantastic manager to all the staff. We have a wonderful 28 people now employed in Cairn, and she is a great leader, and they love her to bits, and everybody puts their hand behind the wheel to make sure that all our visitors feel very, very welcome here and that they go away knowing they've had a fantastic experience.
I want to get into the whole story, because it is just a unique story about what happened during COVID and how you all were able to really survive during that story, Fiona. But first, I just talk about the three nines here. I'm 27 holes, originally designed by the famous Eddie Hackett. He did not move one piece of land with machinery, right? Which is just extraordinary in itself.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. You know, They brought Eddie Hackett in, and he almost immediately, on the back of a newspaper, drew out the 18 holes. We have a great photograph inside of that, because there was no computers then. He came down on the train from Dublin, and he was collected by train, and they brought him out there, and he did all the work on a few expenses for lunches and dinners, and that was about the height of it. And he said this was going to be his masterpiece. He really thought Cairn was a great challenge. And what they did was, instead of bringing machinery in, they took a lot of people off the labour exchange. And it was all spades and shovels, and that's why it took 8 years to build. So while they got going in 86, they didn't actually open until 1993. And then subsequently the 18 holes in 1995. But before Eddie passed away, he actually said that the best bit of the property had yet to be designed into a golf course, and the most dramatic part of the property. And we did that. That again took about 7 or 8 years. The same process, bringing people in off the labour exchange, providing work for them. And it took 7 years to build. And then we opened that soft opening in 2013, but we really didn't have the resources or the money to manage 27 holes. So when Fiona came, one of her first decisions was that we should close that 9 holes to make sure that our 18 was pristine and good, and that it remained within its natural state with the level of greenkeeping staff we had. So we did that, which was the right decision. A lot of people didn't agree with us. And we reopened it. We got a great new greenkeeper in Fergus Kearney. And he was passionate about that bit of land. And Fiona said she released a few bob to him. And the board agreed. And he brought it up to a fantastic condition during COVID. And we opened it in May of 20, just after COVID had commenced. And while the four of us were only working, we had the two greenkeepers, Fiona, myself, in the office. And the rest is history. The Wild Atlantic Dunes went in at number 12 in Ireland, and we hope to take it into at least the top 10 shortly.
It is a great history. You know, I first came to Cairn, boy, I think 20 years ago, and taped a TV show back then. And, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago, Americans did not know about Cairn. They did not know that you could really find such great links courses in Ireland. They would go to Scotland because it was the birthplace of golf, right? Take us through the history of Cairn and how the club actually survived COVID and what you did, Fiona, to overcome the very difficult times.
Okay, so I think I arrived at Cairn in 2017, and it wasn't in great shape financially. So my background, as a lot of people will know, is in finance. I worked for a lot of multinationals. So I came in, take a look at the place, did a sales and marketing plan. So the people who founded the course had such foresight to actually look at that land and say exactly right for what it should be used for, the most fantastic golf course, in my opinion, in the world. It's a unique piece of dunescape. But again, they were volunteers and they were working on a shoestring budget, and it's a great achievement that they managed to get that course where it is. But then times changed in Ireland, you know, the Celtic Tiger crash, huge recessionary times, people weren't travelling. So we really, really struggled here. It was really in a dire financial strait. They really didn't have the means to pay bills and put the investment that was needed to bring the course to its full potential. So we did a financial strategy when I came in, and that included social media, sales and marketing. And we had started work on that in 2017. And 2019, we did a lot of travel. We went to the States to the PGA show, spoke to a lot of people out there, hooked up with a lot of different tour operators, and put in a lot of hard work. 2019, the bookings started coming through. 2020 was the first year that we could look at our bookings and say, fantastic, we'll have enough bookings to make us sustainable. And then COVID hit. And to say we were devastated, nearly $750,000 really in 6 weeks wiped off the books. So that's our year's income. We only have 6 months. We're not a member course. We rely totally on visitor income. For 99% of our income is visitor-based green fees, and of that, around 70% is international. So it absolutely devastated the business. And genuinely, we had to let all our staff go. We have a very small team here. We really do. I know a lot of places say, look, our team is so small. Ours is small. It's really like a family. They're a fantastic team. And to let them go was really heartbreaking. And it affected everyone very badly. So we really didn't know what to do. And then Tom Coyne rang and said, how are you guys doing? And we were like, not great, Tom. And he said, would you mind doing something, he said, and keep a diary as to how the pandemic is affecting this small course on the west of Ireland. So we did that. And when he read it, we sent it over to him. And when he read it, he said, guys, I'd like to do a podcast on it. So he did the podcast on it. And that created such momentum. And because Jerry's podcast, it's a pandemic diary, it's out on the Golfers Journal, it's well worth a listen because it really is a capsule of a moment in time and how devastated we are. It's a very true and authentic record of what happened here. So then the No Laying Up tour guys, who'd also visited Cannes and had done great things for us and really, really helped us out, they also contacted us and said, my God, what's happening? And we were very close to closing at that time. You know, we really were worried. So they also put out some social media stuff. And the next thing, the global, I have to say, I was overwhelmed. The golf has a reputation at times, which isn't fair. But the global golf community came together for Cannes and they saved us. They bought life memberships, people who have, to this day, have never set foot here. A huge amount of North American support. And it was really humbling for us because, you know, with this small course on the west of Ireland, we didn't expect to get that amount of attention. And it just shows the people. We quickly set up an online store, and I had to bring my two daughters in who were sent home from college to help us do the actual online ordering and send stuff out to people. But we were overwhelmed, truly overwhelmed by the response, and still are. And I'm still meeting for the first time some of our overseas members who never came and truly bought a membership just to help us out. And to say we can never thank them enough and that we owe them a debt of gratitude, and to the people like Tom Coyne and to the No Laying Up guys and to Anne Ligori herself, who's always such a stalwart of support for us. Truly appreciate it. And it has made a difference. It's brought Cannes to where we are today.
It's just an incredible story. I mean, the whole global golf community, as you call it, rallied, right? And now you have an International Members Week and everything's positive and the energy is just so uplifting, Jerry. I mean, you've come from almost nothing, right, during COVID to now it's just such a vibrant community here.
Yeah, look, we have to pinch ourselves, I can tell you, because to have such an extraordinary change in such a short space of time is unbelievable. And in many ways, I suppose COVID actually is part of the reason why that happened, because the pandemic diary would never have happened. And that people almost felt part of Cannes just listening to that diary. And we meet them today and we meet people out in the car park and they say, hello, Jerry, how are you? And I say, oh, you're welcome back. And they say, no, I saw you on the No Laying Up, or I saw you on the pandemic, or I heard you on the pandemic. So you walk into those little problems at times and times, which is a great problem for us. But it's not just about Cannes Golf Club. The community, as Fiona said, 2,000 people in Belmullet. The amount of jobs have been created indirectly as a result of Cannes Golf Links being here. The town is thriving, it's flourishing because the golf club is community-based, and of course it's for the community at the end of the day. So the community are gaining by the work we're doing, and we love doing it that because it is a community effort. We're a not-for-profit company. We need to make sure that we have enough to pay the wages, that the course is kept in good condition, that we can replace machinery, that we can have what our customers want. We had too many years here of saying sorry that we hadn't got a buggy for you, or whatever it might be. Now, thankfully, we don't have to say sorry. And as I said, I was talking to people last night, only a few years ago we were saying, can we pay that bill? Now we're saying, can we buy that bit of machinery? And that's the difference that's happened in 3 years.
It's just an extraordinary story. And just in the last few years, you've had some incredible guests here. Bill Murray has been here, the famous actor with his family. And I know several weeks ago, actor Ed Burns was also here, and he's doing a film here. So my goodness, Hollywood, here we come.
Indeed, yes. We had great fun with Bill Murray, and he keeps promising a return visit. So we have the doors waiting for him open. And he did indeed buy a life membership. So he's probably one of our most famous life members. And we're waiting for you to come back, Bill, if you're listening. And Ed Burns indeed came. And look, we had one of the twins from the Harry Potter movie here the weekend as well. So we're certainly getting a bit of international attention. The right reasons.
And there are some exciting future projects as well, including building, 10 cottages right here on the property, Fiona?
Yes, we're looking at developing 10 Links cottages. So anyone who's been to Balmallet will know we have two wonderful hotels and a new hotel opened in Gisala, which is about 20 kilometres away. But if anyone knows Irish people, they have huge weddings and they tend to have them in the summer when we get our good weather. So they do take up a lot of our hotel bedrooms when we need them for golfers. So it's a bit of a barrier at the moment for us for development. So we're looking at developing 10 Links cottages, very traditional, very high end, and we're at the early stages of planning for that. So hopefully we're hoping to turn the sod, all things being well and everything being right, in about 2 years.
Well, I know you all host an incredible International Members Week. What have been the highlights for you this week, Jerry?
Well, I suppose we should thank God for the weather, first of all. We've had a fantastic, as we did indeed last year. And look, it's just fantastic to see 100 people congregating initially last Monday morning and meeting each other for the first time in a year and embracing and, you know, being on first name terms. And it really made me feel like we had a big, big family in Cairn. And that's what we set out to do in the first place. And they're all great supporters in every aspect of the business here. And we just couldn't be without them.
And the former Prime Minister even made an appearance and gave a great talk.
He did. Enda Kenny, who did a great work for this country when he was Taoiseach and Prime Minister. And never lets us down. All we have to do is pick up the phone and say, would he come out and talk? And he's, as we know from last night's few words, he's an excellent speaker, funny speaker, and at the same time quite serious. But left a lovely message last night that just appreciate life and you know, don't worry, live for the day.
Oh, he had a great talk, really amazing. I'm glad when I spoke, I was before him and not after him, because he has a gift for speaking. He certainly does. And, you know, with the popularity of Cairn now, Fiona, the sky's the limit here, right?
Yeah, we're so excited, really, for the next few years. All things being equal, geopolitically, we're living in a bit of a mad world. So hopefully things stay as stable as they can be and things keep getting better for Cairn. Next year's looking fantastic for us with bookings, with the Open being in Portrush. And so hopefully we'll keep getting that spin-off. But yes, it's exciting times for Cairn. And this week's been fantastic. One of the things that I loved hearing this week from all our international members is the way they're interacting with each other outside Cairn. So there are guys going to Canada to play golf, they're going to the Netherlands, to the UK, and that's what we set out to create, a small family in Cairn, and it's working. And just to see, it's been a happy week, a really tiring week, full-on week, but my God, it's a happy week, and it's great to see everyone enjoying themselves.
Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori. And if you are a regular listener to this show, you know I try to cover all aspects of the game of golf. There are so many fascinating personalities to connect with and an endless array of subjects pertaining to the sport we love. And so far this season on Talking Golf, I've dedicated a few segments to caddies, a most important sector of the game. In fact, in our very first show this season from Augusta National, I visited with Hall of Fame caddy Joe LaCava and was engrossed with the nuances of his description of caddying for Tiger Woods at the Masters when Tiger won his fifth green jacket in 2019. Well, in this segment, we say hello to Ward Clayton. No, he is not a caddy. He is a former sports editor of the Augusta Chronicle, former director of editorial services for the PGA Tour, has an incredible resume, but we're going to talk about his new book, The Legendary Caddies of Augusta National, Inside Stories from Golf's Greatest Stage. Hey, Ward, welcome to Talking Golf.
And good to hear from you. Before we get started, your listeners probably notice I've got a Southern accent. So we need to tell people how to speak Augustan before we get started here. So I always tell people that if you say the word tuna and you say the word mint and you put them together, that's the master's tuna mint. So that's the way people say it in the South. So you probably got pretty used to that here a few weeks ago. So that's the way the Southerners in Georgia say tournament.
That's very clever. And, you know, yes, and I heard you speak enough because you sit in Augusta National in the media center right in front of me as you captain the Masters.com coverage, which is wonderful. But let's talk about your book. Now, I know this book is a second edition to your original book on this subject, which was titled Men on the Bag, The Caddies of Augusta. So what made you take a deeper dive into this subject, Ward?
I wrote the first one 20 years ago, Anne, and I don't think anybody had done the research on all these caddies. So they were known by their nicknames. And so I wanted to basically tell who these people were by their given names, what their background was, et cetera. And that was rewarding in being able to tell their story. But over 20 years' time, book went out of print. There was a documentary that came out 5 years ago called Loopers, The Caddy's Long Walk, which Bill Murray was a narrator. We were able to tell the story of caddies at St. Andrews, Augusta, Pebble Beach, the Evans Scholars Program, things like that. And I think it went over really well. But there was a lot of updating and a lot of additional information that needed to be told about the Augusta caddies. Not only, you know, what happened to Carl Jackson, what happened to Willie Peterson, et cetera, like that, but everybody, and also give an indication of some of the barriers these men had to go through just to get to their workplace and where they hailed from. There's a little neighborhood next to it called Sand Hills, next to Augusta National, where a lot of these guys grew up and they could walk to work. So I wanted to tell the story a little bit more in depth about how they got to where they were and how they sort of formed this bond and became these great caddies. And a lot of them were caddies for people that you wrote about in your book. And so I think it really, you know, your subject matter and my subject matter are similar. You've got these great players from golf giving wisdom out, but they also had somebody in their ear generally giving them some wisdom. So
that's a great point. Cool. I mean, yeah. One of the most famous player caddy relationships was Ben Crenshaw. And you mentioned Carl Jackson, and, you know, Carl Jackson holds a record for the most appearances, 54 of being a caddy at the Masters. And he caddied for Ben Crenshaw 39 times, including the two Masters titles that Ben won in 1984 and 1995. And in my book, as you mentioned, thanks for the plug, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. You know, Ben, he talked a lot about Carl Jackson and saying he could not have won without Carl Jackson. I mean, Carl knew every inch of those greens at Augusta National, as you know, Ward. And how did they connect? How did Ben connect with Carl?
A member at Augusta who's from Texas connected the two of them. Crenshaw and his caddy did see eye to eye. So in 1976, Jack Stevens also was the chairman at Augusta National, and Carl caddied for him at the club and also worked for his corporation in Arkansas. So they suggested to Ben that this would be a great guy to work with you. And if you've ever met Carl, which I'm sure you have, Ann, he's this huge guy, but he's very soft-spoken. You would be intimidated to run into him. He's about 6'4", 225 pounds. You would think he could belt you around a little bit, but he's very soft-spoken. So that worked out well with Ben because they had a similar kind of personality. You know, Ben's nickname, of course, is Gentle Ben. And that was the same kind of situation that Carl's in. Carl's the same personality. And they'll both tell you they're not caddy and boss. They're friends first. So it's really a unique relationship among players and caddies for those two.
Well, you know, Ben Crenshaw, his chapter in my book is called Treat People Well and Let Destiny Guide You. And he really talks about the fact that his connection with Carl is really a part of that the fact that he feels like he's had such good fate and fortune through the years. I mean, he really was so appreciative that he met Carl, which is great. I mean, I have not talked to Carl in a long time. What's the latest with Carl Jackson?
Carl is now 77. This year at the Masters on Monday night, there was a special private preview of a documentary that's coming out called Rise Above. And it's about Carl's story of growing up in poverty and in Augusta with eight brothers and sisters and how he quit school at age 12 to go caddy. He had six children. All of them are college graduates. All of them are doing quite well. He had a lifelong relationship with the Stevens family. Warren Stevens, who's now a member of Augusta National, his dad, Jack Stevens, is no longer with us. But Warren Stevens attended this showing along with some members of Augusta National. Ben Crenshaw was there with a lot of his people from Texas. So they were there in humongous support for this project, which was really well done. It was very emotional, told the story of where he came from, how he overcame a lot of barriers, and told the story that I hadn't heard a whole lot about, was the fact that Carl was the first caddy to ever play at Augusta National. Jack Stevens got him to go play with him at Augusta National. Just didn't ask anybody. He just did it. So pretty cool relationship that Jack Stevens had, and also Ben Crenshaw.
Well, you wrote about stovepipe, burnt biscuits, skillet, skinny, marble eye. And as you said, these caddies worked for presidents of the United States, captains of industry, the greatest golfers in the world. How did they all, I'm sure they all had their own individual stories, but how did they first get connected to Augusta National? Did they just show up, or how did they become caddies?
A chapter I added, Ann, is on Sandhills. Sandhills, if anybody's familiar with Augusta National, it's adjacent to Augusta Country Club. And there's these historic cemeteries, and Walton Way has these humongous old 100-year-old homes. And there's a neighborhood right in the center of it, which is a black neighborhood called Sandhills. A lot of these kids, probably like a lot of American kids, you know, when you're 12 years old or something, you want to go make some money doing something. Not a lot, but, you know, they could walk to Augusta Country Club and caddy. And then once they refined their skills, they sort of graduated across Race Creek to Augusta National. Carl tells a story about being able to walk around the periphery of Augusta Country Club, going through a cemetery and coming in a hole in the fence behind the 13th tee at Augusta National to go caddy. I don't think there's any holes in any fences there anymore.
I would think not.
Years ago, that was the route that they took to get over there. And they were smart enough to realize if they made a relationship with a member there, who knows what kind of benefits that could happen. Same way with great players like Carl and Ben. So they developed this skill set, which the players relied on in order to learn how to read greens, how to do yardage. And the best thing these guys had, in my estimation, is they could read people like that. When they're on the first tee, if Ann Liguori is on the first tee and Carl Jackson's caddying for you, he can read that you're nervous. He's going to come up and tell you a joke and make you a little bit more at ease. They really understood how to interact with people. I think that was their greatest skill.
Sure. I mean, they obviously read the greens incredibly well, but they have to be sports psychologists. And as you say, have just good instincts about people, right? Well, you know, the first time I played Augusta National, and I'm humbled to be able to say this, it was the late 90s, and I had one of these famous Augusta caddies, and I'm embarrassed, Ward, that I don't remember the caddy's name, but I do remember just how incredible the experience was, you know, the course, the peacefulness, the scenic beauty, the challenge, and how great this caddy, he was just so lovely to me. And I'll never forget on the par 312, talk about an iconic hole, the most iconic hole, my tee shot landed pin high, rolled into the bunker behind the green, and my caddy went over on the other side of the green in front of Race Creek, squatted down in like a baseball catcher's position, and put his hands up, pretending like he was holding a baseball mitt, And I proceeded to hit the ball from the bunker across the green right into his hands.
He knew so what you, he knew what you were going to do already.
That's he good. Did. And I'm telling you, it was amazing. Of course, he saved the ball from going into Ray's Creek. I wish I remembered his name. I'm just so upset. Now, the second time I played Augusta National, my caddy was younger and told me great stories about caddying for Phil Mickelson. And of course, you know how Phil did a lot of waging on the game.
Yeah.
No surprise there. And then the third time I played Augusta National was in 2017. And my caddy was very, very young. And I must say, not anywhere near as good as the first one I had all those years ago. So maybe talk a little bit about how the caddy culture has changed through the years at Augusta National.
Well, in the late 90s, about the time that you played there, the caddy corps at Augusta National was run by a group called Caddy Master Enterprises. And Caddy Master is based in Northeast Florida, but they do Augusta National, Pebble Beach, Pinehurst, which is where the U.S. Open is going to be this summer. And so they do a lot of the great clubs around the world. So they bring in caddies from all over the world, all over the nation, not just local kids to caddy there. So that's changed the dynamic a lot, but there's still indications that the Augusta caddy heritage exists. And this year at the Masters, there's a perfect example. Ian Finnis, who caddies for Tommy Fleetwood, who just revealed earlier this week he had open heart surgery. So he was unable to caddy at Augusta. So there's a veteran caddy at Augusta named Gray, G-R-A-Y, Moore, who caddied for him at Augusta, and Tommy finished tied for third, which was the best finish he's ever had. And lo and behold, you figure out that every year Tommy came to the Masters weeks before, Gray Moore was caddying for him. Augusta National's process is if you can't bring your caddy to caddy the weeks before the Masters, you have to use an Augusta caddy. So Ian would come and walk around the course with him, and Gray would caddy and say, look, this has changed here. This has changed here. It was almost like a scouting mission. And so Tommy felt very comfortable with the fact that Gray Moore could guide him around the golf course. 70-year-old guy, had his best week ever at Augusta. That was really, really cool. Same deal applies to Ted Scott. Ted Scott comes to Augusta. There's a guy in the caddy facility. His name is Steve Kling, K-L-I-N-G. Steve works there as a caddy. He's a scout. Every year, Ted Scott and Scottie Scheffler come to the Masters. There's Steve Kling showing them around. And Ted Scott's smart enough to stay with Steve Kling every year. He rooms with him. And so he probably gets all the intel ahead of time and probably got some knowledge of the golf course that some of these caddies may not have.
So Jack Nicklaus, the six Masters titles that he won, how many did he have his favorite caddy on the bag from Augusta National?
Well, his favorite caddy, you know, Jack Nicklaus, the second caddy for him in 86.
Right, right.
First five was Willie Peterson.
That's right. That's what I read.
And Willie Ann was exactly the opposite of Jack. Jack was really pretty reserved when he played, but Willie was the kind of guy that if he had a towel over his shoulder on the bag, if Nicklaus had a long putt, he would take the towel and do it over his head like, you know, somebody's hitting a home run at Yankee Stadium or something like that. And he also was famous for stopping by the caddy facility and sticking his head in and saying, hey, I bet all you guys that Nicklaus is going to shoot 65 or better today. So he was a very outgoing personality, which drew a lot of attention to Nicklaus just because of his caddy. So Willie to this day is the only Augusta caddy that's ever been front and center on the cover of Sports Illustrated. 1972, when Nicklaus won, Willie Peterson's in the front with a cigarette in his mouth and holding up the number one like this, and Jack's in the background. So very, very much those guys had a lot of different personalities, a lot of different great skills. Some were great green readers. Some were great club pullers. Some could read players left and right. So they unified with a lot of the same skill set that made them famous.
Is Willie Pete Patterson, is he still around? Willie Pete Peterson?
No, he died in 1999. A lot of these guys, like Carl Jackson's 77. A lot of them are at least in their early 70s.
Sure.
So not as many around anymore. So that's unfortunate, but hopefully with something like I wrote and people are writing more about the caddies and what's going to happen with the Augusta Municipal Course, the patch, in the next couple of years where a lot of those caddies learned how to play, that golf course is going to transform and a lot of people will pay attention to the place they learn how to play, hopefully. So that'll be pretty cool.
Be sure to pick up a copy of my new book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. It's a collection of wisdom shared by 12 great golf legends. Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Tom Watson, Bernard Longer, Ben Crenshaw, and Padre Carrington, Donnie Pepper, Nancy Lopez, Jan Stevenson, Renee Powell, Amy Alcott, and Annika Sorenstam. All 12 share invaluable lessons they learned from their iconic golf careers that they use in their day-to-day lives. The messages are universal. The lessons are universal and uplifting. Gary Player talks about pursuing your passion throughout your life. He's 88 years young and still going strong, doing what he loves to do every day. He works out every day. He eats healthy as well. Jack Nicklaus, he talks about the importance of family, in addition to integrity and sportsmanship. Tom Watson tells interesting stories about learning from the best, picking great mentors, in addition to maintaining humility. Padre Carrington, he talks about embracing fear and nerves, and he reveals strategies that work for him mentally in winning tournaments. Ben Crenshaw and Bernard Longer, they talk about their early childhood and just the challenges they both overcame, and about destiny and fate. Annika Sorenstam, she shares stories about her early days when she learned that there is no shortcut to success. Nancy Lopez talks about positivity on and off the course and how important it is to stay positive in all we do. Jan Stevenson, she shares her incredible story, the ups, the downs of her journey as a professional golfer who helped the LPGA grow in the 70s, and the many challenges she overcame on and off the course. She says that goal setting is so important. Dottie Pepper talks about the importance of preparation. Amy Alcott about being the captain of your own ship. Renee Powell, she tells her fascinating story, how she overcame racism to pursue her love of golf. I mean, there are just so many stories and messages in this book. You will love it. My thanks to Pat Bradley, to Ward Clayton, to Fiona Tohar, Jerry Maguire of Karn Golf Club. As Walt Disney once said, all our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. Have a great weekend. Be kind, be safe. And I look forward to talking with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGore.